It was the fall of 1964, about this time, as a matter of fact, in the year. I was chosen as one of the seventh grade representatives in Thurmont High School to participate in the presidential debate. I have no idea why my teacher, and I can't remember her name, chose me, but she chose two people from the seventh grade, and I think we had three classes in the seventh grade, so that's about 90 kids altogether. But she chose me to participate in the presidential debate. I had no idea what that meant. I was kind of scared to begin with, but nowhere near the kind of fear that I felt when that entire gymnasium and auditorium began to fill up with every single student for an assembly in which the debate would be held. It was my first foray into public speaking. Jeannie Houck was my debate opponent. Severe disadvantage to moi. Jeannie Houck's father was a state representative to the Maryland State House of Representatives. He had been in office for many years. She had a built-in advantage with an insider knowledge of politics that I was not privy to. Grades 7 through 12 all participated in the debate with two representatives from 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12th grade. This means that my brother Hugh would have been in 11th grade, and I don't know if he remembers that time, but to say that I was fearful or scared or petrified doesn't even begin to represent the type of stage fright that I felt. I had no idea how to advocate for Barry Goldwater because he was the candidate I was chosen to represent. I have no idea what I said, and I just know that I stumbled over every single word. I had a scribbled note of sheets, and when Jeannie Houck got up, it was like she was the most eloquent orator that ever spoke in the history of mankind by comparison. I know that much for sure. Now, we all know what happened, or maybe you don't know what happened in that election in 1964, but retrospectively, maybe Barry Goldwater would have been the better choice in 1964 as president. He was an individual that was kind of ahead of his time as a representative from the state of Arizona. I knew very little about him, had to do some homework, and it wasn't as easy to do back in those days, believe me. My father, I think, tried to help me out a little bit, but they all knew it was a foregone conclusion that I was going to lose in this debate because Lyndon Johnson was the overwhelming favorite, and how could that not happen just the year before President Kennedy had been assassinated? And so the entire nation was totally galvanized to be behind Lyndon Johnson, his successor. Maybe Barry Goldwater would have been a better president. I don't know. We'll never know, will we? He was a proudly defiant individual who spoke his mind, let the chips fall where they may, and he had no chance of winning that election from several different standpoints. First of all, the Republican Party of those days was as fractured as it has ever been. It was divided into two distinct camps, a blue blood New England type of, or Northeastern type of camp, and then a very hard rock conservative camp of which Barry Goldwater was the champion. Barry Goldwater lost not only in our high school election, because we had the high school election, I think 90% of the entire student body voted for Lyndon Johnson. Although those votes didn't count, it gave you an idea of what was going to happen in the general election because Goldwater lost spectacularly, gaining only 38% of the popular vote, and only 52 electoral votes. He did carry the state of Arizona, and he carried the Deep South. Only six states for those 52 electoral votes, and they were Louisiana, Mississippi, of course, in addition to Arizona, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. Those are the only states that he carried. And one of the reasons that he carried the Deep South was that he had voted against the 1964 bill, the Civil Rights Act. It wasn't because he was a racist. It's because he thought that that particular question should be the province of each individual state, which was a colossal blunder on his part. I would challenge anybody who is living today to say that the United States is a racist nation. Does it have racists in it? Yeah, maybe a few, maybe a couple here and there. But even as far back as 1964, this nation voted for the Civil Rights Act, which solidified and codified that every single human being had rights, just like everybody, regardless of race, creed, et cetera, et cetera. And 100 years before that, 600,000 people died either for or against slavery, but it shows the sacrifice that the nation made. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, yeah, it was not really, the Civil War is about states' rights, not about slavery. Come on. It was about slavery, mostly. Yes, it was about the rights of states, et cetera, but mostly it was about whether or not people could possess slaves. And the war was won in favor of the North. But at any rate, I would just say that. But one of the reasons, and not the only reason, one of the reasons he lost was because he would not vote for that civil rights bill. The other reason was that the party was fractured and didn't get his full support. He was also cast, shows that politics and politics, nothing is new. He's cast as a radical, itching to put his finger on the nuclear trigger. And, so he lost. But mainly I think he lost because the nation was overwhelmingly sympathetic to the heir of John F. Kennedy and the memory of John F. Kennedy. Well, anyway, in the high school debate, which I was horrible in, but I have a picture of my seventh grade self. I have a picture. Pretty handsome little guy here. So you want to take a look? Anybody want to, you want to focus in? Okay, you don't want to focus in on that. You can look at it later. Pretty good looking guy. You know, I should have won on looks alone, really. So, guy was cute. Oh, well, seventh grade. Anyway, the defeat of the 1964 election paved the way for, interestingly enough, Richard Nixon to become president in 1968, because after he lost, which a lot of people think he probably didn't lose in 1960, but he did. He didn't assume the office, but he didn't contest it because he thought that the nation needed to be consolidated, and he didn't contest it. But there were some really suspicious things that happened in Chicago, and there were some really suspicious things that happened in Texas, especially South Texas. Many of you probably never heard of Far Texas. I remember Far Texas was a city and a county that, I spent a lot of time with when I was a ministerial trainee back in 1975 and 1976, because it was part of the Corpus Christi church area. Suspiciously, when it was thought that maybe there had been a lot of dead people that actually voted in South Texas in Far County that helped Lyndon Johnson carry the county into Texas, the county courthouse where all the records were kept burned to the ground. They never really found out the cause of, but it was suspicious. Also, there were some suspicions that there was some cheating and, you know, voting by a lot of people that either weren't registered or weren't alive in the city of Chicago, which helped the election in 1960, a very, very narrow election to go to Kennedy. But that's all water under the bridge, you know. So at any rate, the presidential election of 2020 has been called by political scientists and political pundits the most significant election since 1860. Maybe they say that every year. I don't know. But they're saying it this year. I know that for sure. Eventually, I see a change in America due to generational change. I think it's just going to happen. The book of Judges is one of the things that teaches us this. But in the meantime, I think there are important questions for members of God's church to examine, because this is going to be a topic that's on everybody's mind, all right? Your mind as a member of the Church of God, on everybody's mind. We live in a nation that it kind of commands our attention. So how should we view government of men? How should we view the government of men? Politics, voting, the news media, and what is God's involvement in all of this? So let me rephrase my purpose statement again. Let me phrase it again. How should we view the government of men, politics, voting, the news media, and what is God's involvement in all of this? My title today is, okay, get this. Here's my title: Government, Politics, Voting, the Media, God, and Guns. Okay, not guns. But I want that to go on the website because it's going to be like clickbait. You know, people, oh, what is he going to say about guns? That's just the attention getter. Okay. Which reminds me of a story which I'm going to bore you with now. After the feast was moved from Tucson in 1997, there were a lot of complaints. And so somebody spoke to one of our congregations to explain the need of the move by saying that the city of Tucson didn't want us anymore. One of the things that was cited to show that they didn't want us anymore was that we were going to have to pay for parking. Another thing was that they were going to run a gun show in opposite of the Feast of Tabernacles. I can't remember whether they were going to have a gun show that year, but the other claim that they're going to charge us for parking wasn't true. But anyway, there was a lot of negative feedback when the feast was moved, so somebody felt the need to defend the decision. And, you know, when they cited the gun show thing, I thought, it doesn't really make sense. A lot of our people would probably go to the gun show. The idea that we weren't wanted, along with all the other reasons that were cited, was addressed. But a lot of our members, I think, would probably be interested in going to a gun show, which brings us to the Garden of Gethsemane when Peter brought a sword. Apparently he had what passed in those days for a concealed weapons permit. I don't know, but maybe did. When reading through the first five books of the Bible, it is apparent that God outlined a system of governance for a nation. And in the book of Deuteronomy, if you'll turn there to chapter 1, you can see that Moses rehearsed, because Deuteronomy means a repeat of the law, and that's what Deuteronomy is. It's, I can't remember the exact term, but it means a repetition, a recapping of the law. And this book was basically the message of Moses to the nation just before they went into the promised land. That's the time period. So 40 years after they rebelled, they finally had the opportunity to go into the promised land. Moses is going to review some things with them. And so in chapter 1, in verse 3, it says, "Now it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him as commandments to them." Pick it up in verse 8. "See, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to them and their descendants after them. And I spoke to you at that time, saying, I alone am not able to bear you." Pick it up in verse 12. "How can I alone bear your problems and your burdens and your complaints? Choose wise and understanding and knowledgeable men from among your tribes, and I will make them heads over you. And you answered me and said, the thing which you've told us to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and knowledgeable men, and made them heads over you, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, leaders of tens, and officers for your tribes. Then I commanded your judges at the time, saying, hear the cases between your brethren and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the stranger who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid in any man's presence, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, bring to me, and I will hear it. And I commanded you at that time all the things which you should do. This is just a brief explanation and recap of the instruction, but it's obvious that the national laws and judgments, which gave rights to families and to individuals, was designed to protect communities and the nations from the result of sin. Sin, breaking of law. It's also obvious that individuals, and this is just implied, I believe, from the time of the Garden of Eden, not anything I think you can turn to, but just by example and experience, it seems to be that God intended men to live in communities, and yes, even cities, and in nations, and learn to get along with one another. It requires human interaction. And with Moses' pronouncements and instruction to all of the nation of Israel in Deuteronomy, it's apparent that he's talking about a word that is sometimes hated by Christians, and that's government. Government used to be one of the things that we talked a lot about in the Church of God, and it was government from the top down. And the government of God was, you know, from led by an apostle all the way through the Church of God. And that's one thing that, you know, we were really strict on when I first came into the church, was how top-down government was God's way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems as though the responsibility, as enumerated by Moses to other leaders, was given to a lot of different people, and he was very trusting. I think you'll have to admit it was very trusting in the sense that, you know, hey, the only thing I want you to bring to me, Moses said, is things that are too difficult, and it kind of migrate up through the body of Israel to me. And if it's too difficult for you, then, you know, we're always going to be looking to God for the answer. But that is government as well. So the rest of this chapter, the rest of this book, details some of those judgments, laws, statutes that would govern a nation, and that is government. It's obvious that individuals weren't intended to just grow up alone, way out in the wilderness by themselves, just with no interaction with other human beings. Man is social, and his development requires him and her to have interaction with one another. And government is simply the means to help regulate those activities and those acquaintances and those families. In Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 1, Deuteronomy 4, 1, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you." And then picking it up in verse 5, "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.' For what great nation is there that God has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are all in this law which I set before you this day? Only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the thing which your eyes have seen and depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and your grandchildren. In this way, the government that God had instituted to the nation was speaking not to masses, not to millions of people, but to individuals within that nation, showing them the responsibility that they had if you'll allow the word, as individual citizens of the land to be obedient to. And it was an individual responsibility primarily that God was giving to them. As a group, as a community, as a city, as a nation, you multiply the effect of that righteousness and greatness accrues to those people. That is government. That was God's government in action. Verse 9, only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. And teach them to your children and your grandchildren, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, that they may teach their children. So, even getting back to the blessing of little children's ceremony, it's nice to have God's blessing without the combined instruction and teaching of parents. It is not as effective, obviously. So you have to have both. God pronounces blessings. He pronounces cursings. It's not that God intervenes or has to actively intervene in either way. It's just a matter of a cause and effect relationship that is present, that especially for this nation, as Leviticus and Deuteronomy show, Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28 show, there are blessings for obedience, cursings for disobedience, but it's not as though God even has to be actively doing any of it. It's just that when you get in line with the principles, then you're blessed. When you get out of line, you invoke these curses upon yourself. So over and over again, the need to be obedient to the law was stressed in the last words of Moses to the nation of Israel. And in verse 40, it says, you shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time. This was and is government. So I think we can conclude that government and governance of and by itself is not wrong. But I think a lot of times people come to the conclusion that when they look at the excesses and the problems and the difficulties, they say all government is bad. And that is not what the Bible, that is not the lesson that the Bible is teaching. With the experience of the nation of Israel at our disposal and for our review, it is apparent that God intended man to live in communities, cities, and nations with laws that would control and regulate the organization within those communities, cities, and nations. And like anything else, government is a thing. It's neutral. It's what you do with it that makes it good or bad or evil or outstanding. By its own intrinsic nature, it's neutral. So I think that maybe there's some misunderstanding about government because so much of man's government has been wrong and has been evil that people come to the conclusion that government is bad. You know, almost, well, I won't say that. But anyway, brilliant minds through history came to see that the societies which work best are where the individual is disciplined enough to manage his own affairs, taking seriously the words that Moses gave to a nation, but not just to a nation, to individual people, and realizing that the nations that work the best and the governance, which really is the best, are where you have a bunch of individuals who take it upon themselves to manage their own affairs according to godly ways. Henry David Thoreau was a philosopher of the 19th century, and he's credited with the phrase, the government is best which governs the least. In Henry David Thoreau's case, it appears that he wrote it with the intent that there should be limits to the control of any government over the individual, and if necessary, the individual should resist the encroaching control of central governments. I don't think Thoreau's sentiment in the context that he wrote it is necessarily perfect, but it's apparent that the founders of America with whom he was definitely inspired. Those who framed the Constitution with the idea that the individual had rights that must be observed by the state, these founders of our nation drew their inspiration from this book that you have sitting on your laps, which protected the rights of the individuals primarily. One outstanding example of the protection of rights of individuals, we could find many, but one real example that actually happened at the time is found in the book of Numbers in chapter 27. This was a situation that apparently had not come up before in the experience or in the history of the nation of Israel. This appears to be towards the end of Moses' life, prior to them going into the land to their own inheritance, but it had to do with a situation that hadn't come up yet, apparently. In Numbers 27, in verse 1, it says, "Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Maker, the son of Manasseh, from the family of Manasseh, the son of Joseph." Got through all those. I'm not sure they're all correct in pronunciation, but I got through them without stumbling. Okay. These are the names of his daughters: Mahiah, Noah, Haggiah, Milcah, and Tirzah. Okay, again, not too many hiccups there. But anyway, these daughters came before Moses, and they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation in the doorway of the tabernacle of the meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord in company with Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family just because he had no son?" You know, that happens. Some families have all boys, some family have all girls, some have a mix, right? But give us a possession. Now they're demanding. They're pretty dogmatic. "Give us a possession among our father's brothers." So Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them." He had brothers. They all would receive an inheritance. He died. If they hadn't gone to have this wrong adjudicated, they may not have received an inheritance. Their father's name might not have, but he had children. They had a right to it. The protection of individual rights. And it also shows that sometimes women can have a good idea. It's a joke. It's a joke. It's a joke. I don't mean it was a joke that they can't have a good idea. I meant it was a joke that, okay, forget it. All right. This is a beautiful example of individual rights being protected by God. Now, the laws in the Bible were represented within the Constitution of the United States, and others have tried to get it, you know, similar. They just haven't. I mean, we're unique. We really are as a nation. We are unique. You look up north to Canada. Oh, yes, they have a great country. A lot of freedoms. They do not have the freedom of the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. They don't have it like we have here. They just do not have it. Their rights to free speech are not as protected here. England is a great country. I love England. Love going to England. Love being in England for a couple of years that I was there. Love to go back. Love to go back to Scotland. Like to go back to the Clan Buchanan area around the Loch Lomond area. Beautiful, beautiful part of the world. Really is. I've been there. I think I mentioned it from time to time. The summer camp that the church had there was right on the banks of Loch Lomond, and it was that very same area that once belonged to the Clans Buchanan. The exact place. There were places There were pubs named Buchanan Pub, Buchanan, the Buchanan Hotel, and other places named Buchanan this and that. I felt like I owned the place, but I didn't. But at any rate, I felt very much at home there for some strange reason. Maybe I just talked myself into it. And if it hadn't been the summertime, though, I might not have felt that way. Maybe in the middle of January, wouldn't feel quite so at home. But at any rate, the laws in the Bible are represented within the Constitution of the United States. And some have made the point, and there's some validity to this point, that Israel, or Manasseh of Israel, or descendants of Joseph, Jacob, is blessed because they have such vast material wealth. And that's true. We have incredible material wealth in this nation. It's really kind of unparalleled in many, many ways, and a small part of the world's population owns a significant amount of wealth. You know why that is part of it? Part of it is this reason. Because you go back to Father Jacob, and you find this guy was ingenious. This guy was an entrepreneur. He knew how to extract wealth. He knew how to build wealth. He was a wealth builder. And that particular national trait has been passed on. Other nations don't quite have the exact same ability. So material wealth is there, but also it's because of our government that we have been blessed. It is a representative government. Other nations have material wealth. You look to the south, the nation of Mexico, incredible wealth. Someday Mexico will be a great, great nation. It will be an unbelievable nation in the thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ with a different government. With a different government that allows the rights of the individuals to prevail. Just a different way of origin. People that came to America came to build wealth. People that went to Central and South America came to extract wealth, send it back to Spain and Portugal. And you can see the consequences even that are far-reaching even today. I've got a good friend. Many of you at least know him by name in the ministry. Don Hooser, he's written an excellent paper. If you'd like, I'll share it with you, but only if you ask. But it has a lot to do with some of the topics that are coming up and prominent in the news today. But I'd like to quote from Don Hooser, my good friend, in this particular way. He said, the American founding fathers were devoted to forming a government based on the Bible, together with guarantees of personal and religious freedom for all citizens. Regardless of one's beliefs, instead of another tyranny, they wanted their new nation to be governed by the people. However, they knew that pure democracies soon self-destruct. In the past, pure democracies have always destroyed themselves, since each citizen is tempted to vote for a candidate that promises the greatest benefits for that individual citizen rather than what is best for his country and his descendants throughout the future. To accomplish their goals, they knew their government required three major things. Number one, a republic based on a constitution and laws with no one above the law. Number two, divisions and balances of power between legislative, executive, and judicial branches of the federal government, with the legislative branch divided into the Senate and House of Representatives, also divisions of responsibilities between the federal government, state governments, and individual citizens. For the three branches of government, there is evidence that the founders got their inspiration from Isaiah chapter 33. We'll turn there. I'll interrupt the flow of his text here and ask you to turn to Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 22, from which Mr. Hooser feels that the framers found some inspiration for the division of government. Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 22. Which says, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us." Judge, lawgiver, king, from which it's certainly possible that the three divisions of American government were inspired from this particular passage. I don't know that you can prove it, but there may be some evidence about that. The framers were well aware of the adage, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So they knew it was essential to limit the power of individuals and the power of each branch of government. And point number three in this particular part of his paper is, a democracy is opposed to any kind of tyranny, whether monarchy or oligarchy. It is a democracy with universal suffrage. What does universal suffrage mean? The right to vote. The right to vote of all citizens with one man, one vote, as Abraham Lincoln described, as a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And for the federal elections, the Electoral College is an essential ingredient for preserving the rights and the privileges of each state. Hence, the USA is a representative democratic republic with universal suffrage, voting ability, and a brilliant constitution based on the biblical principles that defines its government as being of the people, by the people, for the people. The founders were pioneers in establishing this unique system. Since America's founding, other countries have tried to imitate parts of our system, but no other country has yet matched it. Never before had any nation formed a government with such a wise and practical combination of essential features. Never before had any nation formed a government so in harmony with the Bible. Of course, the best government in the past was when God directly ruled over the nation of Israel after they went into the Promised Land. During that time, notice that God gave the Israelites an amazing level of personal freedom. So the essence is government can be good. It can be good, or it can be bad, obviously, but it'll be much better when Jesus returns, as we reviewed recently during the Feast of Tabernacles. So there's always something great to look forward to. Now let me address the term politics. Politics, ooh, bad word. Oh, that's a bad word, bad word. Why'd you even bring it up in a sermon? I was very interested in politics as a young person. My first foray into the debate stage didn't go so well for me. It was horrible. But in 11th grade, I was asked to represent the school. Just looking at this picture, it gives me a little inspiration here. So. In 11th grade, I was asked to go to Washington to what was called the Presidential Classroom for Young Americans, like about 400 kids from all over the nation who got together and toured various aspects of the government and heard lectures. And we met our congressmen, we met our senators, and so on and so forth. But when I went to college, before Ambassador College, my first political science professor argued that we should want politicians in politics. And her reasoning was that politics comes from the Greek word for city, which is polis, and citizen, which is polit, and citizenship, which is politia, and civic, politikos. So whenever there are people in relationships, there are politics. All relationships involve politics, so there are national, state, and local politics, company politics, school politics. Certainly we know there's church politics, family politics, etc. So many people associate the word politics with the word dirty. Dirty politics. But like many things, politics is really neutral. It's a neutral force. It can be good or it can be bad. But my political science professor's thinking was that she wanted people in politics who knew the law and knew how to get things done within the order of government, which I spent a little bit of time explaining. Those people who are in politics should be adept at helping people and serving. That was her philosophy. Now, Matthew 6 and verse 33. Lest ye think that I'm advocating for your relationship with politics, we all believe this very, very much. Matthew 6, 33. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. So we are here today seeking first the kingdom of God. That is our directive. That is whom we represent. Paul said in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 20, to complement this, I think, I'm going to add to it a bit. In Philippians chapter 3 and verse 20, it says, for our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, let me add to that. My brother Hugh, hi Hugh, if you're watching, my brother Hugh was born in the United Kingdom. For a number of years, he had what is called dual citizenship. He was a citizen of the United States. He was also a citizen by birth of the United Kingdom. So he emigrated to this country at age 3. Long story, it involved complicated inheritance situation with my mother and et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, he had dual citizenship. And I would submit to you that you also have dual citizenship. You are a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, but you're also a citizen of this country, whether you want it or not. You are a citizen. Most of you, I think, are legal citizens of the United States of America as well. So I believe that our citizenry is real, and I'll cite the fact that Paul had no problem citing his rights as a Roman citizen when he needed to. And those are well documented. I don't think we need to go to there. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 5. I would submit to you, and again, obviously, you know, I've said this often enough, you should know this, you need to learn how to separate opinion from the Bible, and there's nothing wrong with submitting an opinion. You have to know when I'm opinionating, okay? And I don't speak ex cathedra. Not every word is totally inspired, obviously. But I submit that you have dual citizenship, that you are a citizen of this country, as well as being a citizen of the kingdom of God. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 5 says, for he has not put the world to come, of which we speak in the subjection of angels. I don't think that was the verse I wanted, so I'm going to go to another one. Let's go to chapter 11 and verse 16. Here we are. This is better. But now they desire a better, that is, heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And this is all true. All of this is true. This is what we look forward to in the end. The city of God, New Jerusalem, eternal life with God the Father and Jesus Christ. But it doesn't mean that we have to drop out totally of the world that we live in. Doesn't mean that. Timothy Leary was a professor, a doctor of something, maybe philosophy in the 60s, who was an advocate of using LSD. And he coined the term tune in, turn on, drop out. Tune in to what's going on now, take some LSD, and drop out of society, basically. So not good advice. Don't do that. But sometimes, I think simply from a matter of fact of understanding this world, the evils associated with it, some have chosen to just drop out and not really pay attention to what is going on in the world around them. And I don't think that's appropriate either. So I would say tune in, turn on, and drop in and stay involved to the extent that you can in what is going on in your nation in which you live and understanding what's going on in that nation. I'm not advocating for anything other more than that, but I think that all Christians should be well aware of what is happening in their own nation and be conversant in it. And, you know, really kind of who, with the expertise that you have in the Bible and the knowledge you have in the Bible, who would be a better citizen to know what is going on, especially in a nation which is founded upon the principles and the laws of God himself. It's not perfect, and I'm not saying that it is. Now, a brief comment on the media. The media has changed, in case you didn't know it. Those of you that grew up with the current media state may not understand how much has changed, but some of us who are older realize that when we speak of the media of today, we're not speaking about the bygone era. The bygone era of the church, in which members were encouraged to choose one, get a weekly news magazine, Time, Newsweek, or U.S. News and World Report. It might not be a bad idea to get Reader's Digest every month, too. Remember that? Because that would carry the ads for the church in many times. And it was also just a great publication. But those days are gone, and they are gone forever. Time was thought to be the more liberal of the three magazines for many years. You could read that if that's all you had available. Newsweek, a little less liberal, more middle of the road, and U.S. News and World Report, obviously the most conservative and the one that was highly encouraged for members to get. And then maybe a daily newspaper. That doesn't really happen. I have a subscription, a digital subscription to the daily newspaper of our town. It's not very good. I'm going to cancel it. I don't really get much out of it. So anyway, not very helpful. But the media today includes social media with the giants of Amazon and Google and the rest of many of the big tech companies, which actually don't serve to inform, they serve to influence. And I think even when I was a kid, the news media tried to influence to a certain extent, but not nearly as much as it is today, and most of it leans to the left. So what do you do? Well, be careful with your news sources. And if you're paranoid of some of the big tech and the big media, there are other sources out there. I'm not going to enumerate mine because they're personal. But beware the fact that some of them will take advantage of your paranoia and take advantage of the fact that you may be a little bit less informed about a particular subject, and they will prey on the on your lack of information. So some of that is couched in the way this is being withheld from you. You got to be careful, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to cite any of those sources, but just be careful of the media, because the media today, much of it, is designed to influence a reaction rather than to inform you of what is going on around you. All right, let's get into a really touchy subject here. Let's get into this. Voting. Should a Christian vote? Should a Christian vote in an election? In the past, the active teaching on voting was that a Christian should not vote. All of us remember that. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. The reality is that in today's world, what we have found is that despite those efforts of the past, many members do and have voted in elections for a long, long time. The iron fist of the church in directing your personal decisions hasn't been around there. Some people determined that that was a personal decision and they were going to do what they wanted to do. Personally, I don't see anything in the Bible that prohibits a Christian from exercising that right, or some may call it an obligation, as a citizen. You are free can be, to disagree with my point of view. Just feel free, bring it on in the chat with the messenger. Do whatever you want. Hate me. Scowl at me. Oh, Buchanan, he's getting liberal. You're free to disagree with my point of view. But if someone were to ask me, I would tell them it's an individual decision. And some of the reasoning that we have used sometimes in the past, like my citizenship is in heaven, well, there are a lot of other rights that all of us claim as citizens of the United States: the right to drive a car, the right to get a driver's license, the right to pay taxes, although I'd like to give that one up. I don't know about you, but the right to do many things as a citizen are given to us, and we don't reject those rights. Sometimes we don't claim all of them. And for me, it's not a matter of the church voting as a bloc or a group, like they're going to influence an election, because that's not a consideration. As a church, we cannot make a dent in almost any election, local or national. If we all lived in the same neighborhood in this group, if we all lived in the same neighborhood and were governed by neighborhood association, what are those called? Homeowners Association, then you bet we could get together and block vote and we could change the direction. But otherwise, that's not the purpose. And I think that most members who view voting in an election as their citizenry obligation look at it as a personal thing that they should do as a citizen rather than something that is an obligation. They view it as a right and a privilege, and I prefer to keep it in that way. And as a minister, I'm just not going to tell people, the Bible prohibits you from voting, because I sincerely do not believe that that is the case. The last topic of this sermon, no clapping now, okay. Does God choose our leaders? What is going to happen on November 3rd in the presidential election? How involved is God in this decision-making process? Have you ever wondered that? Will God choose the next president of the United States? Did he choose President Trump, President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, President Bush, President Reagan, President Carter, President Ford? You know where I'm going with this. President Nixon, President Johnson, President Kennedy. Did he cause the Farr County Courthouse to burn down to elect President Kennedy? Did he elect President Eisenhower or choose President Truman? All those are the presidents that have been elected since I've been alive. Or wait a minute, we better count out Truman, because the election was already over in 1952 when I was born. So it was Eisenhower. So we'll stop at Eisenhower. I think there are a fair number of members of God's church who actively think God chooses all world leaders. So I'm going to pose the question to you as we close today. Does he? Does God choose the leaders? I did a little research on this. I went back to June 1959 in the Plain Truth magazine. I actually didn't look for this. I kind of stumbled across this. Let me read this phrase. This was in a question and answer on should Christians serve on juries. And the answer at that time was that you should not serve on a jury, as many of us will remember, and it remained like that for a long, long time. And the article goes on to say that if you vote in an election, then your name is going to go into the pool of jurists. So don't vote, and your name won't go into the pool of jurists, and you won't have to face this decision, which has not been true for decades, because they went to other sources. Nobody wants to serve on a jury. We found that out. But from the June 1959 Plain Truth magazine, in the question and answer section, remember that? In the Plain Truth, you have questions that people submit and there's answers. Here's part of the answer on jury duty. Note this, which is consistent with our teaching forever about what has happened in the world since the Garden of Eden. I quote, God is allowing the nations in this age to rule themselves. God intends that the nations should judge in matters according to their law. I believe that. I believe that statement is true. Let me read it again. I quote, God is allowing the nations in this age to rule themselves. God intends that the nations should judge in matters according to their law. And I think that that is the truth of the matter, that God does not choose the leaders of this world. But I believe that there has been a misapplication, perhaps, of several passages in Daniel. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 2 and verse 21. And I would encourage a thorough review of this entire chapter to look at the context and all the passages that I will cite, to look at the context of the times and the context of the individual that was being addressed. In verse 21, Daniel is speaking, and he is speaking to a king. One person, Nebuchadnezzar. He changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Let's turn to chapter 4 and verse 17. But do not forget that the context of this particular information was given in the context of a dream that was directed to Nebuchadnezzar, who had to find an answer to what this dream meant. Him. This is part of the answer of Daniel. Chapter 4 and verse 17. This decision, what decision is mentioned in chapter 4? Chapter 4, again, Nebuchadnezzar is addressing the world, and he is being given information. He is explaining what happened to him. He says, this decision is by the decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. Who is the lowest of men? Nebuchadnezzar. And then chapter 5 and verse 21 is the wrap-up of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar when he was proud and lofty and lifted up and not humble and disregarded all this great instruction that God was giving to him through the prophet Daniel. In chapter 5 and verse 21, it says, then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of the heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints it over to whomever he chooses. I believe that all of these instances refer to the specific instance of Nebuchadnezzar only, with which God was dealing with a monarch in a unique way with a prophet, a way that we don't find replicated in the rest of the Bible. Now, in Hosea chapter 8, you'd think if God's involved in choosing all leaders everywhere, then certainly he would be concerned about the leaders of his own people, you know, the people of Israel. But notice this in Hosea chapter 8 and verse 4. Hosea was sent to give up a message, and it says, they set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. From their silver and gold, they made idols for themselves that they might be cut off. So God is not always involved in choosing all leaders. He wasn't involved in choosing leaders. Israel was choosing their own leaders or allowing their kings to ascend to the throne. Jeremiah had some interesting observations for people who were exiled to Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 14. Jeremiah 14 and verse 15. It says, therefore, says the Lord concerning the prophets who prophesy in my name, whom I did not send, and who say sword and famine shall not be in this land. By sword and famine, those prophets shall be consumed. Sometimes God does not use individuals who claim to be his prophets. Chapter 19 and verse 5. Chapter 19 and verse 5, they have also built the high places of Baal to burn their sons, which with fire for burnt offerings for Baal, which I did not command or speak, nor did it come into my mind. God didn't cause or force Israel to do this, obviously, because it was wrong. It was evil. He allowed it to happen. In chapter 23 and verse 21, He says, I have not sent these prophets, yet they ran. I have not spoken to them, yet they prophesied. But if they had stood in my counsel and had caused my peoples to hear my words, then they would have turned them from their evil way and from the evil of their doings. My view is that what we have always taught is accurate, is that God has allowed the nations and the people of the world to have free moral agency since Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden. And if you think about it, if you hold God responsible, or if you think God is placing every leader or all human leaders or some of them, I don't think you can have it both ways. You can't say God has had a hands-off attitude towards mankind and then also say God chooses the leaders of human nations. I don't think you can have it both ways. He's either hands-off, as we've always taught, or he's involved. I guess you'd have to say he'd be involved in putting despots in power like Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot and all the rest of the evil, and that involves God and the evil of mankind, which he is not a part of. God does not put evil leaders in charge. He's not involved in the evil of this world. He has allowed man to develop his own institutions. But I do believe that for the people of Israel, and specifically for Manasseh, I believe that the Bible was the inspiration for our Constitution and for our nation and for our laws, and that the nation, to the extent that it obeys God and obeys his laws, can be blessed, no doubt. I really believe that one of the things that got Donald Trump elected in 2016 was his stand on abortion when he looked directly at Hillary Clinton and said, "It is wrong. It is just wrong." And nobody has ever had the courage as a presidential candidate to actually say it in that way. So, brethren, America is at a crossroads. It is decision time. What'll happen? I don't know. But it will be, in my view, again, agree to disagree. It will be the will of the people, or it will be stolen from one or the other of the candidates through corrupt actions. And we can see that sometimes in history that might have happened before. It may have happened. But whatever the case, some of this message is my opinion, and I approve of this message.